Chromebooks are more popular than Macs, the future of the TSA, and some bad, bad Venmo etiquette. All that and a whole lot more coming up on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1517, recorded Thursday, May 19th, 2016. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Igloo. Igloo is an intranet you will actually like. It connects people with the information they need to do their best work. Try it for free at igloosoftware.com/twit or sign up for a live demo to see it in action. And by Epson's new EcoTank printer. With Epson's line of SuperTank all-in-one printers, you can print thousands of documents without running out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to find out more. Hello and welcome to Tech News Today. This is a show where we talk about all the latest technology news stories with people who are passionate about talking about all the latest technology news stories. I am Megan Maroney. Jason Howell is braving the onslaught of Google developer news at the Google I.O. conference in Mountain View. But joining us today is Lindsay Turrentine, editor-in-chief at CNET. Welcome, Lindsay.
Hello, it's good to see you. I haven't done this for a while. I'm excited.
I am excited too, and it's just us chickens. No,
that's right.
Nobody else. So I'm really glad you're here to talk about all the news, and especially to get your opinion about all the Google news, especially the smart home stuff. I've been watching you on CBS this morning occasionally, just giving all your laying out the truth, the smart home truth.
That's right. We are all about the smart home. There's a lot to talk about.
There is. So let's start with the smart car. Ride-hailing company Uber has confirmed that it's testing its self-driving Ford Fusion on the streets of Pittsburgh. The test car from Uber's Advanced Technology Center is a hybrid, and it will be collecting mapping data while it puts its self-driving mode to the test. A trained driver, of course, will be in the car at all times. Where do we think this puts Uber in the self-driving car race, as it were?
Well, I think that Uber is in the driver's seat, honestly. I mean, if you think about it, Uber has more at stake here in helping to develop self-driving technology than pretty much any other company because, you know, automotive companies just want to make cars that people want to buy. Uber wants to sell a service. And to be honest, its HR problems are its biggest problems, right? Like if you were a boss at Uber, you'd be saying, oh, there are all these lawsuits about whether or not our contractors are actually employees. Let's just get rid of that whole obnoxious problem and not have drivers.
Exactly.
Which is, you know, pretty cynical, but I'm sure absolutely true.
Yeah. It's funny you said driver's seat then, because there's no driver.
That's right. In the not driver's seat.
The no seat? I don't know. Yeah. It's fascinating. I mean, this race, like it seems like Google is really, to me, looks like in terms of technology, pretty far out ahead. But then when you think about all the infrastructure for like a ride hailing service, that really, I mean, Uber has all of that. Earlier this week, there was the news that Waze is sort of developing, you know, working on developing a car sharing, which might be like their lead in to, you know, to developing like an app for the self-driving car hailing service. But yeah, it is exciting to watch it, I think.
Absolutely. And to watch all of these companies who have different reasons for developing different pieces of technology. I mean, when you think about Google's motivations for developing these technologies, it's really all about using the data from its mapping services to eventually come up with something that it can, I would assume, monetize. Who knows? Maybe it sells all that information to Uber. Why not? I mean, yeah. Google is just about data. Mm-hmm. Google's not necessarily about selling cars.
That's a good point. Yeah. And, you know, Uber's working with Ford and Lyft is working with GM. So it does seem to be a lot of disparate groups working together. And I mean, and I, you know, if you've been in an Uber or Lyft, like they use Waze, they don't have their own mapping tool to get around. So, yeah, it would make sense for all of them to work together.
I think that nobody really has a strong handle on how long it's going to be until we all sit in these driverless cars. And so that's what I am dying to know.
Yeah, it's probably not going to be before our children get driver's license, which is what I was hoping for, but I don't think it's going to be that soon.
I was hoping for that too, but then I thought about it for a while and I was like, you know what? No, it's kind of like learning how, you know, it's learning the basics. I want them to be able to know how to drive.
Good point.
You know?
Yeah.
So they'll learn.
So in a rare moment of regret, some ransomware purveyors seem to have had a bit of a change of heart or just got lazy and stopped trying to torture people. Creators of the ransomware TeslaCrypt have themselves released a master decryption key to researchers. Security researchers at ESET say the cyber criminals have actually said, sorry. So you can, if you have had this ransomware on your computer recently and you haven't already paid up, you can go to Bleeping Computer to find out how to get all your files back for free. That's so cute. They just said, we are sorry.
Yeah, I like that there's no contraction. It's not we're sorry. It's we are sorry. Yeah. We are so sorry. I wonder why. I wonder what happened. I wonder if somebody like listened to a really great piece of reporting or read an article that just made them feel sad for a victim. I know.
It's when you think, you know, like when you, everyone always talks about that. I think it was a This American Life where someone calls up a troll and, you know, finally has this conversation. And the guy is just like, I don't know why I did it. You know, I'm so sorry. I said all those really horrible, violent things about you. I didn't know what I was doing. So
I didn't know you were a real person.
Right. So maybe it was that sort of situation. I don't know. But maybe. It's exciting and maybe hope for the future.
Yes, it is a ray of sunshine.
The Google news continues to pour in from the developer conference in Mountain View. Today, the company announced that your Chromebook might be about to become more useful. 1 million Android apps are coming to Chromebooks. Some of the most useful apps like Google Photos and Google Play Music can also work offline now. Google Play Store access will come to Chromebooks in September, although not all Chromebooks will have access right away. And I'm wondering what you think, Lindsay. Do you think this is some sort of beginning of an Android Chrome OS merge?
I think that this has been a long time coming. And I actually think that this is going to, I think, you know, in a little bit in the show, we're going to talk about the dominance of Chromebooks. But I think this is going to help sort of solidify Chromebooks as a legitimate choice for people other than students, but people who might want to buy a Chromebook from home. The limiting factor for a lot of people is that they cannot do some of the desktop things they expect to be able to do, whether or not Google thinks you should need to do them. So I think that allowing people to run apps on their Chromebooks is going to make a huge difference for the kinds of users who feel limited by living entirely within a web browser.
Exactly.
I think it's been a long time coming.
Yeah. I mean, they point out just a range of, you know, Skype will work, and Office apps will work, and Minecraft will work. So
that is really important.
It is.
Really.
Yes, it definitely is. So yeah, it's available to the developer channel with M53 on the Asus Chromebook Flip, the Acer Chromebook R11, and the latest Chromebook Pixel. Have you tested many Chromebooks? Is that something that you've ever used in your work life?
I use a Chromebook at home every single day. Well, my kids do. And it works really well for them. But there are these moments where they're sort of like, why can't I do this on the Chromebook? And I have to sort of explain, well, you know, it's got these limitations, but we're also, you know, I have Android users in my household and they're just going to be thrilled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it does seem exciting, and some, especially if you're in the Mac iOS ecosystem. It's just not something that you can really do easily yet. So I don't know, it could cause some switchers. But it does lead into the other Chromebook news that you mentioned. An IDC analyst says that Chromebooks have officially outsold Macs for the first time in the U.S., This is mostly due in part to their adoption in K-12 schools in the U.S. What do you think about this, Lindsay?
I think that this is fascinating because this is an example of Google beating Apple at its own game. Right? I mean, Apple did this first when I was a kid and we had Apple computers in every single classroom. There was never an expectation that there would be any computer other than an Apple computer. And all of a sudden, Google gets way out in front by once again tackling services first, really getting the services right, taking advantage of the fact that the cloud is now viable and a way to drive down costs, and then providing really, really inexpensive and easy to maintain. That's the important part, technology for classrooms. You know that most school districts do not have the money to hire an entire IT staff. Chromebooks are a great way to keep classrooms from having to deal with a bunch of, you know, outdated operating system security problems, and Apple has fallen behind there. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's just a really, really interesting moment.
Yeah. And so I guess now Chromebooks are more than 50% of the new devices in schools. And where Mac shipments actually rose, PC sales fell. And so some of this was just estimates, but the IDC did tell The Verge that it's pretty accurate. It is really interesting that we've talked about this. Jason and I have talked about this a few times, and we've had, you know, ed tech experts kind of call us out because, you know, we have iPads in our school district, just one-to-one iPads. They started this year. It's been fine, but, like, there are just so many things, especially as your kids get older, that they need to do with a keyboard and that they can't really do with an iPad. But then there are a lot of things that you can do with an iPad or a tablet that is harder to do with a desktop. And obviously, you know, the Chromebooks that my school wants to buy, they want parents to just pay for them and buy them so that they could also have them.
Of course they do.
They're $250, you know, which is crazy. I mean, and a great price for a tool that I think is really useful.
Yeah, absolutely. And kids still, I mean, we can debate whether or not in 10 years down the road, kids are even going to need to know how to type. But I would say I don't see typing going away anytime soon. And they now learn kind of very early. And I think the ability to use that keyboard quickly is really important. And I also think that some of the work that Google is doing with the Pixel and the touch screen will eventually filter down to those cheaper, you know, like Samsung issue, Acer issue, mm-hmm. Chromebooks, and then the iPad conversation will be a little bit less meaningful also.
Yeah, it's interesting too. I mean, I think Jason Howell on Twitter was saying, you know, oh, well, opening up the App Store to a Chromebook, doesn't that then cause, you know, the problems that they were avoiding originally? And I mean, I do think that there will be a way to lock that down in schools. The iPads that my kids have in schools are locked down. They're locked down, so you can't install any apps. I think it took, like, some, you know, kids maybe 4 months to figure out how to get around that.
Right.
Which I think is, you know, that's part of education, too, teaching them how to hack the system, which is helpful if they want to become white hat hackers or other kind of hackers.
I know that my son's school, the kids, did not take them very long at all to figure out how to use Google Docs as sort of a side chat channel.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So to speak. That happened pretty quickly.
And it is, I mean, it is interesting because Google is pushing so hard. I mean, all these companies are pushing so hard into schools for both, you know, good and bottom line reasons. But all the school Google Classroom is great for using and sharing and using Docs. And but then on the iPads, it's just such a horrible experience to use Docs and Sheets on the iPad. And so I hope that something happens where, yeah, I do think this is a good push for them, for Google, to have the apps that you can use that are also great in a school system and to have the lockdown system as well.
Absolutely. I think it's, yeah, like I said, I think it's just an interesting moment of Google using what its strongest abilities to kind of be Apple at its own game.
Mm-hmm. So yesterday, Google announced the Google Home, or Google Home, I guess. I don't know if that's the Google Home. It's not a home. It's a voice control.
It's Google Home.
Google Home. They have just the weirdest naming over there. Anyway, it's a voice control device for your home that's designed to answer questions, stream music, and more. So you are a home tech expert, Lindsay. CNET has its own smart home testing all these things. What are your first thoughts about Google Home?
Well, my first thoughts are that it's poised to do very well. And there are two major reasons for that. I mean, one is that, and we've been kind of talking about this the whole show, right? Google is all about data and what it can do with data. So this is true when it comes to self-driving cars. This is true when it comes to the cloud-based services that it provides for in-school computers. And this is really true when it comes to any sort of AI for your home. And when you think about this product as a direct competitor to Amazon Echo, it makes a ton of sense that Google might be able to step in where Echo has been trailblazing and really actually just kind of kicking ass and taking names all over the place. But to come in with a really robust AI backend and make it easier to ask really organic questions and answer those questions over a home-based system. And then also tie into the entire Nest ecosystem. And as we know, Google owns Nest. Nest has been struggling a little bit to make its way within the Google ecosystem, but this might be the first indicator that they're finally finding a good way to marry all of Google's many strengths with the great home empire that Nest has built.
So in the CNET smart home, how does the Amazon Echo work? What does it control in the smart home, the CNET smart home?
So what we have found about Echo in the smart home is that it is by far the best smart home hub. And, you know, this gets a little bit nerdy, but this show's, you know, a little bit nerdy, so I can get nerdy. You know, right now, in order to make a smart home really integrated, to have lots of different devices in a home working together, you usually have to invest in some sort of hub. You can't just go out and buy the devices and expect that they'll all talk to each other. There are a number of different hubs out there on the market. Most of them have just kind of tried to sell themselves, you know, like Samsung SmartThings, as a hub. And that's it. Amazon came at the Echo that right out the when it first came onto the market, it was really just a Bluetooth speaker that had some AI and could answer some questions, but then opened it up in such a way that smart home developers could all experiment with trying different integrations. And Amazon Echo has become kind of the best de facto smart home hub because it works with the most products and it's voice activated. And we found that voice is the best and most sophisticated way to control a smart home because it allows for lots of different people to interact without having to set up separate apps and profiles on different devices, right? Like, you're never going to have your four-year-old own their own smartphone from which they control the light bulbs. But you can teach a four-year-old to say, you know, and apologies to anybody with this in their house, but to say, Alexa, turn on the lights. And that's something that a four-year-old can use very easily. And without having to set up a lot of different profiles, it actually just sort of naturally works with different people in the home. And so it makes a ton of sense.
And so I think, you know, there are various things that are making Google Home more interesting. I think I read that it will work. You can have many of them and they'll work together. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. So that's something that that Amazon and the Echo products don't do very well right now. You can't really network them together, but the Google products, they say, will be able to do this. Now, it's important to note that nobody has actually touched one of these devices. There wasn't even, you know, we looked everywhere at I/O for this product that you're seeing in video right now. It looks like a little urn or, you know, another Bluetooth speaker. The Google Home product was not available for testing or even taking pictures of outside of the demo that Google did on stage at I/O. So nobody has actually played with this yet, but Google is saying that this will be the case, that they will work, multiple of these products will work together within the home, and that they will be out this fall.
And so we're watching the video too, and it has the Chromecast. I mean, it will work with that too, which is nice. I mean, there's nothing. Have you been able to use the Amazon Echo to control TV in any way?
So far, we haven't used Echo to control TV. There doesn't seem to be a bunch of integration for that. Although lots of people use like IFT channels to set up all kinds of interesting integrations. There's sort of, if you're a real smart home enthusiast and you don't mind hacking around, you can figure out a way to get Echo to control almost anything. But for most sort of normals, there isn't a lot of TV integration. We do use it a lot for lighting. You can use it for temperature control in lots of different situations. We use it to do things like control garage doors, smart fans, you know, a lot of physical aspects of the home.
So the one drawback I'm hearing a lot of rumbling is just, you know, people who are reticent to have a device from Google that's listening to them all the time in their home. What do you say to that?
I say, do you have an Android phone? Because if you do, you already have that device.
And I mean, if you're searching Google, you're already giving a lot of information. If you're using Gmail, you're giving a lot of information, but not in your home necessarily, not what you're
not
talking
necessarily,
about.
Not necessarily. But, you know, I mean, any modern smartphone is probably already doing a lot of this, right? I mean, Siri does this. All you have to do is say, hey, Siri, mm-hmm. and it's listening to you. So, that exists. It's part of how, you know, if you want to participate in a modern voice controlled ecosystem, then that's your reality.
And so what do you think about price? I mean, they said nothing about price. I am wondering, I'm really curious. Wait, do you think people will be willing to pay more for this device because of what we talked about and because, you know, you might be able to hook it up to your Gmail, your calendar, your Chromecast? Do you think, or do you think that they're going to try to go under a lower price point than the Amazon Echo in order to sell them?
I'm just guessing, but I guess that they will go one-to-one. I suspect that they will price it the same way as Echo, and they may have a couple of bonuses that try to convince you to buy to choose this product rather than one of the Echo products. There now, the thing that's interesting to me is that there are now, you know, three Amazon products that integrate Alexa for the home. So there are three different models. I don't think that Google's going to come out with three different models at three different price points in the fall. I'm guessing that they'll just come out straight with a 180 or really close.
Yeah, because I have the Alexa or the Echo and the Dot, and it's very frustrating that they don't work together. And I have to give them different names, different wake words, because they otherwise they'd be setting each other off and they wouldn't be simultaneous. But yeah, I mean, I the other thing I've heard about the Google Home is the speaker is better than the original speaker in the Echo. Which I think that's why I have the Dot. It just hooks up to my Bluetooth speakers and then it sounds great. So yeah, I think it'll be interesting. Because I think the other thing that Amazon did is the price really changed. I think that I only paid $100 for it when I bought it in January of 2015.
Demand went way up.
Yeah. And then, and it's just very interesting the way they're making money because, you know, if you weren't already a Prime subscriber paying $100 a year, you only could get it if you were a Prime subscriber. So, you know, they automatically know that people, once you have that and that's your hub, as it were, like you're probably going to continue to pay them $100 a year for the rest of your life.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Amazon pricing is always sort of interesting. Amazon's all about volume, all about pricing, but also about continuing to make money off of Amazon services, right? So Amazon really wants you to be continuing to pay that money for Prime, you know, ordering paper towels through Alexa verbally, which I have done, by the way. It's actually, you know, it's pretty easy to be like, buy this thing right now. Google doesn't have the same motivations. Google wants you to use its services, and so they need to make enough money to offset the cost of developing the product, but they're not going to be under the same pressure to make money off of the sale of the product, I believe, which will be interesting. I don't know. I mean, we have no way of knowing whether that speaker will actually be any better. Based on what I've seen of Alexa and Echo and the full tower, that 180 tower, it's not going to be, and this may sound blasphemous, but it's not going to be that hard to make a speaker that sounds better. Because it's just not great, to be honest.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know this for sure, but presumably I give Google $100 worth of my personal information at least every year and probably for the rest
of
my life.
More. Yeah, absolutely.
So, Lindsay, is there anything else that you're working on or that CNET's working on that we should know about?
Well, you guys should know about some of the great reporting we had out of Google I/O. We actually had a lot of really exclusive and wonderful content, including an interview with Sundar Pichai. So come to CNET right now and check it out because it's some pretty great looking stuff.
Yeah, it's a great read. Also, the design is wonderful. Like I love the way you guys are writing those longer pieces. It's awesome. Well, Lindsay, I know you got to go. So thank you so much for talking to us. Lindsay is the editor-in-chief at CNET. Thanks so much for coming on. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Megan. This is super fun as always.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
So after the break, if you're planning your summer vacation, the TSA wants to ruin it. But first, let's take a minute to thank Igloo, the sponsor of this episode. Igloo is an intranet that you'll actually like. It's a cloud platform that helps you share files, collaborate on documents, blog updates, coordinate calendars, and manage projects. Anyone can add content based on their permissions with a drag and drop widget and a WYSIWYG editor. Igloo also offers a variety of access, authentication, and identity services to ensure that only authorized users have access in private clouds over SSL and with 256-bit encryption. Unlike other solutions, you can customize Igloo to fit your needs and work with your current IT investments like Office 365, Salesforce, SharePoint, Active Directory, and file sharing solutions like Google Drive and Dropbox. You can even add Zendesk to keep track of and add new support tickets. It's used by large enterprises and growing companies like User Testing, BDO, American Family Insurance, and ATP World Tour. You can try it free at igloosoftware.com/twit or sign up for a live demo to see it in action. And when you sign up through our link, You can get your own Igloo for up to 10 people, absolutely free for as long as you want. That's igloosoftware.com/TWIT, and we thank them for their support. And now it is time for our Trains, Planes, and Automobiles segment, which today is just planes and automobiles. Joining us is Jordan Golson, transportation reporter from The Verge. Welcome, Jordan.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. So this afternoon you posted a piece on the troubles with the TSA, which I'm sure if anyone has flown any time recently have experienced. Last week, executives from all the major U.S. airlines brought their complaints of those long lines and delays to the TSA and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. What can you tell us about what's going on with it?
Well, there's a lot of theories for what's causing these really long lines, and it's not clear whether one is more true than the other. The TSA says that it's due to an increase in people traveling and there's just more people, but the airlines say that's not true, and maybe it's just underfunding, or there needs to be more screeners or something. No one can really agree on what the problem is. Everyone can agree, however, that there is a big problem.
And we can't do anything about it, right? Like as flyers and the airlines can't really do anything either.
Yeah, as flyers, you're sort of stuck, with the exception of TSA PreCheck, which is a program that you can get into for $85, and it gets you into a special express line that lets you not take your laptop out of your bag. You don't have to take off your shoes, things like that, and it can help bypass a lot of the waiting. And that's what both the airlines and the TSA have said people should do. And there's also another program called Global Entry that does that as well. And so that's really the only thing that people can do other than show up at the airport really, really early. And the bummer part for that is that you might end up with no line at all and you can just walk right through.
And then just eat their delicious, expensive food.
Yes, exactly.
So there's been some talk about maybe hiring private security, like airlines or airports hiring private security. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, there is a TSA program that allows airports to opt out of TSA security and have hire private security to do that under the guidelines that the TSA has established. SFO Airport in San Francisco is the largest one that's done that, and they seem to do a pretty good job. Whether other airports are going to do that remains to be seen, but the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which is in charge of LaGuardia, JFK, and Newark airports, wrote in a letter to the TSA administrator that they were considering that program, which was sort of read as a bit of a threat to the TSA to get their act together or else.
So you cover a lot of different kinds of transportation. I mean, there's stuff we hear constantly about electric cars, hybrid cars, self-driving cars, the Hyperloop. So much technology involved in making all those kinds of transportation better, easier, Uber. But with airlines, it just feels like there's nothing going on there.
Well, at the moment, it feels like that. There are some interesting things that are coming. It's just that the airline industry moves really slowly. There's a new car coming out every other week, but the new planes are a little more rare. A couple of things that are coming. Delta Airlines has a new RFID tracking system for luggage, and they hope to make sure that more people get their luggage shipped to them, things like that. Like you said, unless you're spending a ton of money and you're flying in first class, where there's lots of interesting developments. There's a Middle Eastern airline that has a three-room apartment on the A380 that you can buy for $15,000 a segment or some ridiculous amount of money. But for the rest of us in the back, about all you have to look forward to is Wi-Fi and maybe TV shows in the headrests, which is not too bad if you've got that.
That's true. Yeah, maybe not safe Wi-Fi, but Wi-Fi.
Yes, there's Wi-Fi, and they are rolling out new versions of that are going to be faster and work on international flights and things like that. So that stuff's coming. I don't know if being able to check your email during that six-hour flight when you thought you could take a nap, but now you have to work is a great thing, but that's what we have.
So no Uber for TSA lines yet?
If you're very wealthy, sure. You can pay to bypass those lines, or if you are a frequent flyer or you have elite status on the airlines, sometimes you can bypass those lines that way. But for the rest of us, The line is where we are.
So you've also been following a really interesting story that the San Jose Mercury News reported that they originally reported that Tesla was paying factory workers $5 an hour. And I've heard about this, was checking your Twitter. You were going back and forth with Elon Musk about this. What can you tell us that you learned?
So the Mercury News reported that basically that a Tesla contracted out with this company and the employees that were working to build a paint shop in their factory were being paid not enough money, and that one fellow in particular got injured on the job and was having to file a lawsuit to get workman's comp and things like that. And of course, attaching the Tesla name to anything is sure to get coverage, and that's what they did. Doing a little bit more digging, and as Tesla has responded to this story, they hired a subcontractor called Eisenman to build the paint shop. And then that contractor hired another company to bring in employees. And so it's a subcontractor that had this employee who got injured and was supposedly paying them $5 an hour. We don't know if that's actually true or not, but the information that we got yesterday that Tesla released was that they were paying that subcontractor $55 an hour per employee. For those jobs. So it seems, if the Mercury report is true, that that $55 an hour did not make it to the employees who were actually doing the work.
Yeah, that's unfortunately a common story, I think, with contract workers and the in-between people. So, you know, there's in the car, self-driving car world, there's a lot of people that just say, like, I want to drive. I am a driver. I don't want to give up my car. Are you one of those people?
No. I'm not. I used to be, but at this point, you know, if you go and have to sit in traffic to get to work every day and you're sitting there for an hour and it's stop and go and stop and go, if you could just let go of the wheel and have the car handle that, that would be pretty nice. Also, we have a lot of people killed in car accidents. And, you know, if your car can drive itself, it will save lives. And I think that's a good thing. And if you look at the number of people killed in car accidents every year, it's about a little over 30,000 a year. If we can reduce that number, we can make a real big impact for actual people's lives, which is hard to say in technology a lot of the time. You know, if you can make my computer a little bit faster or my phone a little bit better, that's great, but it's not going to save anybody's lives. And this is a type of technology that can actually really save lives.
But for now, we still have cars, and you report on a lot of them. And so there are some new smaller Volvos out there. What can you tell us about those?
Yes, I'm a big Volvo fan, and they just unveiled their concept cars. For what they think will be the future of, you know, their small car, which has not been in America in a while. Volvo hasn't had small cars here, and they've had them in Europe, and they're really great little cars. But now, starting next year and then into 2018, they're going to come out with these new things, which is their 40 series. There'll probably be an S40, which is going to be a sedan, an XC40, which is their SUV, and they're very cool small cars. They don't really look like anything else on the market. So hopefully it'll shake things up.
Well, Jordan Golson, thank you so much. Jordan is the transportation reporter, one of the transportation reporters at The Verge. Where's the best place where people can follow all of your work?
You can follow me on Twitter at JLGOLSON, JL Golson, or TheVerge.com/transportation is where to find all our great coverage.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Megan. I appreciate it.
Take care. So here's our feedback section. C. Brian Jones wrote in Twitter about whether it's acceptable to say emojis, or is it always emoji? I think that technically it's emoji, but I said that it's become acceptable to say to emojis. But he says, tech guys, please stop saying emojis. You don't say kanjis. Both are borrowed Japanese words. Plural is emoji. If you want to email me, you can email me at megan@twit.tv, or you can find us on Twitter, too, and we'd love to hear your feedback. And after the break, it's the TNT Fan of the Day and a story about tiny flying robots. But first, let's take a minute to thank Epson, the sponsor of this episode. Epson's revolutionary EcoTank line of printers for home and office introduce a new age in printing. The new EcoTank ET4550 wireless all-in-one printer doesn't use ink cartridges. Instead, it features an innovative refillable ink tank, earning it the title of CES 2016 Innovation Awards honoree. The EcoTank ET4550 comes with enough ink to print up to 11,000. 1,000 black pages or 8,500 color pages. That's equivalent to about 50 ink cartridge sets. You're loaded and ready to print for up to 2 years. Powered by Epson's leading-edge precision core technology, it delivers high-speed, vivid colors and laser-quality black text, plus auto two-sided printing, a 30-page auto document feeder, and easy wireless printing from tablets and smartphones. All EcoTank printers deliver an unbeatable combination of convenience and value with ultra-low-cost replacement ink bottles. Epson recently released their Creative Print app, making it easier to preserve your Instagram and your Facebook photos. Download the app to create personalized photo collages, custom greeting cards, stationery, and coloring book templates. You can also print photos directly onto CDs and DVDs. Be creative on the go. Print from your mobile device to a variety of compatible Epson all-in-one printers within your wireless network. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank today to transform the way your home, office, or workgroup prints. For the best combination of ease and value, turn to the new Epson EcoTank printers. That's EPSON.com/EcoTank. And we thank Epson for their support. Venmo, you've probably heard of it. It's a peer-to-peer mobile payment system that's taken off with millennials. But our guest today says it's also been turning people into petty jerks. Carrie Paul, writing in Quartz, wrote about this phenomenon, and she is here to chat with us about it. Welcome, Carrie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for coming on. So for those who don't know exactly how Venmo works, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. It's an app that connects to your bank account, and so you can just send micropayments to friends or family. It's very useful for dividing bills, dividing utilities with roommates. Just anytime you have to charge or request money from someone.
So you talked to a 24-year-old Venmo user named Stephanie, who had an interesting experience with Venmo. Tell us about it.
Right. This girl who had me change her name because she didn't want her friend to see her calling her out, went to a friend's house to watch TV and catch up for the night. And after kind of hanging out and having this chill night, she was walking out the door and received a Venmo request for $6 for the cost of one glass of wine that she shared with her friend that she had offered.
So that's weird. And you say this is kind of a common occurrence now. People are sort of using it just to avoid the awkward situation, but maybe to create some additional awkward situations?
Yeah, I think it's just the nature of the app. A lot of people have been reacting to my article on Twitter and saying, well, your friends are terrible or your friends are stingy, which is not the point I was trying to make with this article at all. I think it's when you have an app like this, it makes you a little bit neurotic, like, and it's self-perpetuating because, oh, this friend charged me for the cab last night. I guess I should charge her back for the one drink I bought her. And then the next time we go out, I'll think to charge her the first time. And then it just gets out of control. And it's becoming just every time you hang out with your friends, there's a tab in your head going on.
I found this so fascinating because, I mean, I think I'm probably a little bit older than you. And I do remember when I was younger and you go out with a bunch of people and it was really awkward and you'd end up like someone wouldn't pay and you didn't know. And so this does seem to make things easier. But that's horrible that you can imagine just like going out for coffee and someone says like, well, I'll pay this time and then you pay next time. But then, you know, just losing that and having some, you know, just and you leave and have the app show up. Oh, I owe you for that coffee that you just bought me.
Yeah, it's definitely good for settling up bills. And of course, if you have a friend who's always freeloading, you can charge them and it's not as confrontational, I guess. But yeah, it's just gotten a little bit out of control. I think once I've talked about this theory with some of my friends and ever since we've discussed it, we've kind of like laid off the Venmo. Tried to go back to a more sharing, caring system.
So do you think that there's something about this app that makes it appeal to younger people?
I think so. I know definitely for me and my friends, I mean, I live in New York City. We go out a lot to restaurants and things like that. And so it could be really, really useful for things like that. Also in New York, I've noticed people don't, like waitresses and wait staff at restaurants really hate when you ask to divide the bill or kind of divide it based on who got what. And so it's convenient for that. If you're a vegetarian or you didn't drink at all at dinner, you can divide it that way. And obviously it's an app, so it's really convenient. People can use it a lot.
So I'm not exactly sure how it works. So how would you divide a bill with Venmo? Everybody has it and then you just, how does that work?
So a lot of times people will, if there's just a bill for the whole table, one person will put their card down and pay the whole thing. And then everyone will Venmo them like, oh, I got this entree and two drinks. You got one drink and this cheaper entree, and just kind of like divide it that way.
That still seems complicated.
I know. Complicated. I just went on a trip with friends this weekend, and we would all just, one friend would pay and we would just divide it equally by three and or four and just be done and so, not have to count everything.
So when you say you're laying off the Venmo, I mean, does it seem like one of those technologies that is purporting to be make things easier but really making things more difficult and awkward?
It makes it a little more awkward. Or I feel like everyone has this anxiety in the back of their head now when they go out, like, oh, I have to think of all of the charges I did over the night so I can Venmo someone tomorrow. And it's just making every time you go out with friends seem a little less free and carefree and a little more structured. But obviously, it is really convenient in some ways. I'm not saying that no one should use Venmo. I use it for utilities with my roommates. Like I said, splitting up bills sometimes. If someone buys tickets for a concert, one person will buy them all and we all Venmo them, things like that. It's really convenient. But just for going out and normal day-to-day activities, it's just gotten a little excessive.
So what would you say good Venmo etiquette is for, how would you advise people? Like, is there like a limit or a situation where you would use it or not use it?
I think there has to be a balance. Like, if you get to the end of the weekend and you think, oh, you paid for me a lot this weekend, do I owe you any money? And a friend will say, just Venmo me $20 and we're good. I'm not going to nickel and dime it, something like that. Or just warn someone in advance, like, hey, I'm going to get this cab. Will you get the next drink? Like, they're, you know, just communicating in person instead of through an app notification.
Well, Carrie, thank you so much for enlightening me on the Venmo, the world of Venmo. Fascinating. So you write for Quartz. Where else can people find your work online?
You can follow me on Twitter at @Carrie_Paul, and I write for a lot of different outlets, and I will tweet out my work there.
So what's your beat besides dinner etiquette apps?
Yeah, I write about tech and culture a lot, so kind of where those intersect. I've written for Motherboard at Vice and Cosmopolitan, a few other places.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. Take care.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Thomas Silva is the TNT fan of the day. He sent us this video. That is him listening while he's taking boxes and moving them around somewhere. Thank you, Thomas. You can show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video. Thank you. We love videos, as you can see. Take a picture of yourself or your setup. Post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we will find it. And finally, Mashable reports on a joint project between Harvard and MIT that has created tiny robot bees that could assist in search and rescue efforts. The robots use static electricity to perch on various surfaces so as to not waste time flying around. Electrostatic forces keep their insect-sized flying robots stuck to a range of surfaces so they can use less energy and stay aloft longer than your standard micro robot. MIT says the tiny robots can be used not just for search and rescue, but surveillance and research in places where other sensors can't go. So welcome, robot bee overlords. I'm sorry for stealing honey from your organic ancestors. And that is it for the tech news today. Tomorrow's guest will be Ian Thompson from The Register. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv or leaving us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. You can also find us on Twitter. We are at Tech News Today TV. Subscribe to our show. We love subscribers. And tell other people to subscribe. Also, if you think they might be interested, they can do that at twit.tv/TNT or wherever fine podcasts are available. And you can find me on Twitter. I am at Megan Maroney. Thank you to our technical director, Anthony, and all the folks who help us produce this show every single day. And thanks to you for sticking around till the end. We will see you tomorrow.